Hey everyone, welcome. My name is Louisa Morse. I am the division chair of STR, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to this virtual event on how strategy research can engage with the state. This year, STR are running several events on impact and relevance, so please keep an eye on the STR homepage or our social media for advertisements of the next events. I'm sure that we're going to have a very interesting conversation today, and thank you very much to the esteemed panelists for being here and participating. And also a very big thank you to Richard Whittington for organizing the sessions and moderating the panel today. I'm going to hand over now to Richard to introduce today's event and also to introduce our speakers.
Hello, everybody. Wonderful to see you all. We're really delighted to run this session because strategy in the state is possibly a subject we wouldn't have considered two decades ago. I think nearly every day, in the contemporary world, we are reminded about the importance of the state, whether it's the European Union intervening and trying to regulate artificial intelligence, for instance, whether it's the Chinese state with its large state-owned enterprises, or indeed even the United States imposing sanctions regimes and similar. So the state is everywhere, highly important topic at this moment. And we're really delighted to have a panel of five experts who will be speaking on this in the coming 1 hour and a quarter, or just less than that. I'm delighted, by the way, to say that we also have three continents represented here, and that's important. It would have been lovely to have had five continents, but such is the concentration of research, I think, in North America, this is a fairly natural distribution. We'll be starting with Aline Gatignon from Wharton. Then we'll move on to Anthea Zhang from Rice. Then Mike Peng from Dallas. Pasha Mahmood from NUS Singapore. And then Anna Grossman from Loughborough. Each of them will talk for 12 minutes maximum. Hopefully that will allow a minute perhaps for a quick question and a quick response. And there will be some time, hopefully, at the end for a little bit of Q&A to the whole panel. However, the beauty of Zoom, if there is one, is that we have the chat function. Please do use the chat function. I've encouraged the panelists to keep an eye on the chat. And please just put questions, recommend readings, make observations through the chat function. And the panelists will, I think, try and respond. Of course, they've got their eye on two things at once, so they may not be immediate. But let's use the chat function as much as we can, because that makes it much more interactive. There will be chance for Q&A, but the chat function is a great way of doing things. I think I should stop here and hand over to our first speaker, Aline, who's going to, as it were, set the scene, I think.
Thank you so much, Richard. And thank you so much to the STR division. And Louisa, this is a really great opportunity to learn more about this topic, what other people are working on, and get some feedback. So I really appreciate it. Thank you. Let's see. Can you see my slides? Okay, great. So I'm going to talk about this convergence of kind of three actors within research and non-market strategy: the firm on the one hand, the state on the other, and civil society. And I'm going to interrogate whether kind of the space in the middle there has traditionally represented a bit of a Bermuda Triangle within non-market strategy, where maybe some interesting questions have gotten sucked away. But I think there's a real resurgence of opportunity and interest there. And I want to kind of steer your attention towards one specific area of that with an example from my own work. So if we think about evolution of non-market strategy, there's heavily been an emphasis on the relationship between the firm and the state, which makes a lot of sense. As per Richard's introduction, the state is kind of all present and very influential. And so this literature has often considered, the influence of the state on firms and how firms can navigate that potentially to their benefit. On the other hand, we have this other set of actors: civil society. Think of them as nonprofits, NGOs, community-based organizations, et cetera. And what's really distinctive about them is that they are separate from the state and the market. And this is their defining characteristic, right? They really are kind of the third sector. Over the past few decades, though, there's kind of another stream of non-market strategy that has really started looking at the collaborative interactions between the firm and civil society under the form of typically corporate social responsibility. And we've seen increasing research interest in this area, commensurate with, I think, increasing practice of corporate social responsibility. And so even as these two areas have flourished, you can see that the triangle is kind of incomplete. And we've traditionally had, I think, these two literatures often in different conversations. And what I've been really excited to see lately has been this emergence of a lot of fantastic research that's actually kind of connecting the dots across the three, and I think giving us a much fuller and richer panorama of the interactions between these three actors and what non-market strategy should reflect here. And so here's just a couple of examples. Illustrative, it's by no means exhausted, but these are papers that I've just tremendously enjoyed reading and that I think give us a lot of nuance in the way we think about the relationships between these three. What I will say, though, is that I think they've often taken the perspective that relationships between the firm and civil society are either being influenced by the state, and we're seeing that increasingly with, you know, state mandates for disclosure of social responsibility or even to do social responsibility, or that perhaps the firm is actually using its interactions with civil society to somehow gain influence and goodwill from the state. And so we're really often kind of focused on what are the benefits to the firm, with potentially some implication that it's not obvious what the societal outcome might be. This is really important research, I think, as academics. It's our role to be able to help society and actors better understand where people are maybe not necessarily walking the talk and saying what they're doing, and to understand both both sides of non-market strategies, both what the firm might be doing that is maybe not such a win-win, and other places where there's a lot more potential for value co-creation. And that's where I want to kind of steer our attention today. And I'm going to give you an example from my own work. So the idea being, you know, how can these three actors working together, rather than influencing each other, perhaps indirectly, how can they co-create value for each of these actors in society as a whole? The example I want to give, this is from joint work with Julien Clément, Léo Pangelupé, and Luc Van Wassenhove. And we study an organization called the North Star Alliance. It's a nonprofit organization. And really its role is to help address the lack of healthcare access for marginalized populations across sub-Saharan Africa, in particular long-distance truck drivers and sex workers who are kind of excluded de facto from traditional healthcare systems. They're often mobile, located far away from traditional health clinics. They have different schedules from traditional health clinic schedules. There's also issues of stigma associated both with HIV and AIDS and sex work. So for a lot of different reasons, they're really not getting access to the healthcare they need, but also they are potentially contributing to the spread of the disease as they move along these transport corridors that span multiple countries across sub-Saharan Africa. And so, as you see, because they're spanning multiple countries, there are multiple governments that are involved, and really these populations are falling outside of the net of what those governments are providing. And so it's important here to note that these clinics that they establish, North Star establishes in transportation containers by the side of the highways in what are called hotspots, where places where sex workers and truck drivers spend a lot of time, maybe because there's a border crossing ahead and they have long wait times. And these are places where they can get them access to health, and they can bring healthcare to these populations in a way that's adapted to their needs. So we have this network of clinics across these transportation corridors, and clinic managers who are interacting with each other to provide consistency in and quality in how they're providing care, but also really looking to be embedded in their local settings. And so each clinic manager what they're attempting to do locally is to be kind of a piece of the puzzle. So the missing piece of the puzzle in existing healthcare systems, not to replace anything that's currently existing, but kind of to add to that, to bring care to populations that are not benefiting from traditional systems. And so what these local managers are going to do, they have the autonomy to create their own combination of cross-sector partners on a local level, which might be from the for-profit or nonprofit or government sectors. And so, for instance, one clinic could partner with local bars or restaurants. They could partner with companies that use truck drivers for transportation. They could also, on the other hand, be working with nonprofit organizations, whether it's kind of NGOs who do development work or healthcare work, or also community-based organizations like the local dance troupe who's going to do outreach for them. But a really important piece very often of these partnerships are government organizations, whether it's institutions such as the Ministry of Health or the government health clinics that are already set up and that provide traditional forms of healthcare to the population as a whole. To give you an example from one of our interviews with North Star representatives and clinic managers of how important they can be in partnership, they say, you know, if you spoke to the government nurse or the clinical officer from the government facility, you would have thought they worked for North Star because they knew so much about North Star and they would communicate so freely about what North Star does. And you can see that they're really kind of operating jointly. And so these partnerships are really key. The data collection here really spanned a couple of different stages. And our objective was really to understand what's kind of the optimal combination of the internal communications that these clinic managers have among themselves and with their regional headquarters and global headquarters. Right. And the stakeholders locally that they decide to work with and partner with on the external side. And so there was quite a bit of qualitative work, and the main kind of bulk of the paper is based on QCA analysis. I'm going to give you a brief overview of kind of the main insights from the paper, the findings, and it's really going to be just a snapshot, but I'm happy to follow up offline. What we find is that there's a key distinction between the choice of more homogeneous versus more heterogeneous partners and fewer partners or many partners at the local level. And essentially, when you're bringing in more homogeneous partners, you're going to focus on the nonprofit and government sector. They have kind of clear reporting guidelines, needs. They might bring tangible resources to you, such as in kind of a potluck model. And then your regional headquarters can actually help you with some of the administration of that in a fairly efficient way. As you bring in more heterogeneous partners, however, then you're going to have to spend a lot of time kind of being multilingual and talking across sectors and across different kind of ways of organizing. And that's going to take a lot of your focus. And it doesn't really necessarily, it's very locally embedded, doesn't necessarily require you to coordinate very much internally. However, if you want to kind of get a combination of the two, so very heterogeneous, but a larger set of partners together, where you could really kind of start building some scale, then you're going to need both to spend a lot of time on these relationships, but also to have a lot of support, in particular at the regional level, where you're going to have people who are really going to kind of help guide your partnerships. I'm going to flip just an example from this last this last configuration, where the leadership of North Star try to give these local coordinators autonomy to manage these partnerships, but also to give them techniques for saying, say, don't commit yourself to this. When you enter a conversation, be conscious that you can't go beyond this line. If you feel pressured to do that and you're in a tight situation, we've tried to build up these escalation measures so they can always kick it up the management line. And then we can bring in somebody who doesn't have that local pressure, and that's really effective. So here you can really see these synergies between the external relationships you choose to engage in and the nature of your internal interactions. And that's really what we're kind of trying to bring out here. And so, you know, if you want to work with the government on these value co-creation strategies, these are three different paths through which you can do it. And they're going to require a different kind of internal organization. So just to conclude, in terms of kind of our topic for the day, I think this is there are huge opportunities within non-market strategy that really bring together the three actors in this triangle. And I think some really important directions to start probing is, you know, when and how does these kinds of collaboration happen? Can we consider kind of the role of direct kind of partnership ties versus more indirect ties where we're gaining access through a third party? How can we think about different governance mechanisms for getting stakeholder synergies, but also kind of offsetting the coordination costs of working with these very different partners and organizations? And then thinking really hard about who is actually benefiting. Are we thinking about kind of influence rinse versus value co-creation? In what ways are each of these actors, getting something out of these interactions? And what does it mean for society? I think are really key areas where strategy research can bring a lot to the table. So thanks a lot for the opportunity to share some of this work, and I look forward to exchanging with everyone on the chat and in Q&A.
Thank you very much, Aline. You did a really good job in both introducing the topic, especially with the triangle of state, civil society, and firm, but also a great job in keeping to time. So if anybody has a particular question to ask of Aline, please do. I think we can deal with one on the Q&A. If you raise a virtual yellow hand, that would be probably the most effective way of drawing your attention. Does anyone want to raise a yellow or whatever hand you want, a digital hand? No, you're all too shy. Ah, right. Is it Ona?
Hi, yes, it's Ona.
Please go ahead.
Thank you so much. I will be the first one to break the ice. Thank you so much. Really interesting work. And I was just wondering, when you were talking about the differences between partner types, so firm, and I put it in the chat as well, firm, government, civil society, is there no differences within these categories? So I can imagine, for example, that government offices are very different and have different interests and values as well compared to this topic. And also firms from different industries or civil societies active on different micro issues. Can you explain a bit more about that? Thank you.
Yeah, for sure. So that's a great question. Thanks, Sona. So I think there are kind of two parts to the answer. One is that there's for sure a lot of heterogeneity within each of the sectors. And definitely in this context, you'll see, for instance, how do we work with a logistics company that employs truck drivers across, multiple countries versus your local bar where you have sex workers and truck drivers congregate, right? And same thing, as you said, between government ministries versus local government health clinics, et cetera. And nonprofits, of course, there's a lot of diversity there. That said, I think what prior research has shown is that each of these sectors has kind of a different way of, and I'll point attention to Lita Nardi and Sinzi Durabantu and Vitas Hennis's recent paper, where they actually show that, organizations from stakeholders from these different sectors require different ways of communicating with them. And I think there's, a lot of work kind of showing that the vocabulary, the language, the interests, there was another question on the dependent variable, right? The objectives of each of these sectors are going to differ. So I would say, yes, there's going to be, more involved as the diversity within as well as across sectors increases. At the same time, I think the difference across sectors increases more the complexity than that within sectors.
Fabulous. Thank you, Aline. Perhaps you could put the Durabantu reference in the chat. But thank you very much. And thank you, Ona, for breaking the ice. That's wonderful of you. Thank you. We'd better get on with Anthea next, please, if that's all right.
Okay. Can you see my slide? Great. Well, thank you, Richard. Thank you, Louise, for inviting me. It's really my pleasure, my honor to join this esteemed panel. So today I'm going to share a working paper with my co-author Yu Li from University of International Business and Economics. So my paper is about the foreign direct investment location choice, and more specifically, you know, how firms decide which foreign countries to invest. You know, so in the international business literature, it's well known that for international expansion, there's huge uncertainty, right? You just don't know, you know, which country market offers the best opportunity, which country market has like high risk and how to deal with, right? Especially from the perspective of emerging market companies, because for many of them, it's very different from multinational companies from Europe, from the US. They have, you know, 100 years experience. They can draw from their own experience. But for many emerging market multinational companies, you know, this probably is their first few time to invest abroad. They don't have experience. So the question is that, you know, how do they decide locations for their foreign direct investment? Well, when you don't know what to do, a logical choice is just look around to see what others are doing and learn and imitate from others. So the literature has highlighted the importance of inter-firm imitation in foreign direct investment location choices. For example, prior study have found that, you know, firms imitate similar firms from in the same industry, firms from the same business group, etc., and a firm with similar size or firm with better performance. Just look at how those either peer firms or leading firms are doing and imitate their actions. So in this study, we bring in the state ownership, right? We look at how the state ownership may affect inter-firm imitation in foreign direct investment locations. Basically, you know, in a very simple way, we divide firms into two groups. One is like state-owned firms and non-state-owned firms. Our basic question is that, you know, who likely imitate whom? Very simple question. But let me draw you to the background of this study, right? This chart shows that, you know, Chinese companies outbound foreign direct investment in the past 10 years. One trend you can see that, you know, overall it declined till like 2022. Mm-hmm. Probably we updated with last year data, probably kept the decline. And also comparing the two color bars, right? The light green one indicating the merge acquisition value continued decline since like 2019. So this one shows Chinese companies' foreign direct investment in the United States. Well, you probably will not be surprised. It peaked in 2016, and after that, it dramatically declined. This shows Chinese companies' foreign direct investment in Europe. Similar pattern, but less dramatic compared to in the prior one about the US. And I want to draw your attention to this one. It's again about the Chinese companies' foreign direct investment in Europe. It separates SOEs investment from non-SOE investments. So the yellow bar are for non-SOE, the red bars are for the foreign direct investment by SOE. From this chart, you can tell that, you know, actually state-owned company have been very active in foreign direct investment. Remember, this is in Europe. Just imagine in Africa, in countries along like One Belt, One Road initiative, the state-owned company are probably even more active. So this is the news back to 2008. That was kind of at the beginning of the civil war of Sudan. So according to this news, China's special envoy, you know, would make his fourth, not the first, but his fourth visit to Sudan. Overall, although the overall goal is to, you know, contribute the peace, stability, and development and Darfur region. But it, you know, if you read more broadly about that time period, CNPC, you know, China's oil and gas giant, actually had a big oil field in the southern part of Sudan. So you can see that, you know, that the government from China went to Sudan not only just for the overall goal of keeping peace, stability, development, but also to offer political protection for big oil project that was made by a big state-owned company. The question is that, you know, when the government sent their envoy to Sudan, well, yes, state-owned companies buy Chinese companies, certainly they can benefit from that. Now, how about non-state-owned companies from China? Would they benefit from that? You know, probably yes. So this comes to our overall frame, right? We call it a pyramid of influence and protection. At the top of the pyramid is a state. The state has its strategic goal. They offer resources, you know, and direct as a strategic mission to state-owned companies. But when state enterprises face challenges in overseas market, the state also offers political protection to the SOE overseas investment. Then such political protection can be spilled over and also benefit from non-state-owned enterprise investment in the same region. So if you think about from the non-SOE's perspective, you know that you are vulnerable and you know you are going to somewhere, right? Where are you going to choose locations? You probably want to look around to see where the big state-owned enterprise invests in. So that's why we come up with our general framework, say that, you know, if basically if a host country is politically more risky, then the imitation becomes more salient, right? So if, you know, in a country that already has a large number of investments made by Chinese companies, then a new investor is more likely to invest in that host country, especially when the host country's political risk is high, to highlight, you know, the important role of political risk. And then goes to the question, SOE versus non-SOE. Our basic argument is that, you know, non-SOEs are more likely to imitators because they are in a more vulnerable position, right? They are more likely to be profit-seeking, but they know they are vulnerable, they seek protection. That's why when non-SOE make a new investment overseas, they are more sensitive than SOEs just to look around in the host country and say, hey, you know, who else from China have already invested in that country? That you take that as information cue. And our second prediction is that, you know, compared to non-SOE, SOEs are more likely to be imitated. Because remember, like, if when SOE, they are faced challenge, they are in troubles, their home country government is more likely to send help overseas. So, and brief background about the research context, we look at, you know, Chinese companies' outbound investment in the period of 2001 to 2013. Reason is that, you know, before 2000, China's outbound FDI was really relatively sparse. And also the One Belt, One Road initiative announced in 2013. So after that, probably investment logic might be very different. So we look at the gap window between 2001 and 2013. I'm not going to bore you with all the measurements. I'm just go directly with, you know, the results. So overall, we found that, yes, you know, the number of Chinese invested company in a host country has a consistent and a positive relationship on the likelihood that a new investment is going to be made in that country. And also to show that, you know, the political risk level of the host country play a positive moderating effect. To show here, if you can see that the yellow bar means that a host country with high level political risk, then the imitation effects is much stronger than the green bar inside when the political risk is much lower. Similarly, we also found that, you know, if the new investor is SOE, is not SOE, which is the green bar, then the imitation effect is much stronger than the, you know, the yellow bar when the new investor is not SOE. So then we separate, right, the existing investment into by non-SOE and SOE. If we put them separately in different models, you will say, oh, both of them matter. But when we put the existing investment by SOE, non-SOE in the same model, which is model four, you can see that, you know, the number of SOE investment has very stable, consistent effect, but impact of existing non-SOE investment is significantly reduced. So in this table summarized, basically, as you said that, if the new investor is SOE, they really don't care about how many investment made by non-SOE in the country. They may look at investment by other SOE, but not non-SOE. But if you're a new investor, it's a non-SOE, they still pay much more attention to the SOE than attention to non-SOE. So, okay, I stop here just in case, you know, we have any questions.
Thank you very much, Anthea.
Thank you, Richard.
That's fabulous. And coming from a country where there are going to be more state-owned enterprises in the near future, that's quite fascinating. There'll be one or two questions, one quite a tough one from Louise, I think, in the chat. Mm-hmm. I suggest that we deal with the questions via the chat. There's also, okay, I see some quite interesting correspondence between Stephanie and Aline. So there's plenty going on in the chat. Keep them going. I'm going to mispronounce your name. I'm sorry, Ching. I'm sorry. Perhaps you could put the question in the chat to Anthea. And then, of course, everybody will have a chance to respond and join in that way. Thank you very much, Anthea. That's wonderful. And I saw some rounds of applause. I would join that as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think we should go on with Mike, if that's possible.
Sounds good, Richard. Thank you for inviting me. Let's go ahead to share my screen. Okay, are we seeing my slide? Okay. All right, wonderful. Good morning, good afternoon, good day. Thanks so much for coming here. I would argue today is really a day of festivities. A day of festivities. We're coming here to celebrate the emergence of research agenda, increasingly focusing on the state. There are lots of ways to slice and dice this beast. I want to present this short paper on corporate diplomacy and exit strategies, collaborating with Jane Lee and Danny Shapiro from Simon Fraser University. The word diplomacy has been widely known and widely noted, and the art of diplomacy has been practiced by hundreds of years, if not thousands of years. As a chat function, if I could recommend one single book on diplomacy, that's Henry Kissinger's book. I fell in love with it when it came out in 1994, and I'm still periodically rereading that book. Highly recommend it. But you know what? Traditional practice of diplomacy, and there's also quite a bit of research on diplomacy, they never bother to note that it is at the country level. Specifically, it's about country level diplomacy. Well, talking about our firm level work, right? We deal with multinational enterprises, MNEs. And all textbooks traditionally assume that MNEs from a single country are supposed to be supporting and importantly be supported by their home country diplomacy. Their home country government is right behind them. So all they need to do is the third bullet point, that is they go around entering different countries. So they obviously need to focus on how to deal with host country governments and also host country stakeholder groups. But we now live in an increasingly complicated era. During this era, some of these assumptions have to be revisited, sometimes have been refuted. That is, MNE interests and activities may not necessarily be supported by their own home country government. For example, numerous Western MNEs spent decades of their time and energy building up a large market in Russia since the early 1990s. And all of a sudden, 2022 happened, the invasion happened, their home country governments demanded, coerced them to withdraw from Russia. Well, what do you do as corporate executives, right? So that becomes a hot question, a relevant question, a timely question, but also, I would argue, an under-researched question. We as a field just have not done that much research, but practitioners have to make decisions right away on the spot as bullets are being fired and people are being killed. So how can MNEs pursue the interests that sometimes diverge from those of their home country government? And that is a challenging question. I don't think we have a good answer. And we are here providing taking some initial steps. There are many answers, but one answer I would argue is to use corporate diplomacy, specifically using our jargon and many non-market political and social strategies that both respond to and shape country-level diplomacy. Jing Li, Danny, and another colleague of ours 2 years ago published one paper on corporate diplomacy in the age of US-China rivalry. And so this is the first time we are presenting the second piece out of that stream of work. In fact, today is the first time, and I have presentations scheduled after this particular event. I would take advantage of an opening case of my own teaching on day one. This is also the opening case of my own textbook, Global Business, fifth edition. And that is a hard case about Apple, China, and America. And take a look at this Apple CEO in the middle. He is engaging in what we call corporate diplomacy in two countries. All right. And there is some likelihood that we are going to see President Trump term two. Then this cartoon will become very relevant again. So in terms of corporate diplomacy, we are not only talking about Trump, Apple dealing with the Chinese president and the Chinese government in a host country sense. Apple also has to deal with the US government. In fact, you know, the cartoon can only capture one president, but ever since President George W. Bush, every US president raised this question in front of Apple's CEO. Why couldn't Apple make the iPhone in the United States? It's a very difficult no to say to your president. You've got to be very diplomatic. So long story short, I'm not going to be burdening with a lot of details. But long story short, Apple has been able to play ball in both countries. I mean play ball, to keep itself in the game, okay, instead of dropping the ball. And when the US and China relationship was relatively good, it was already very extraordinary to be able to deliver that much value as Apple did, according to the resource space view. You know, you got to have some very valuable, rare, and hard to imitate capabilities. And as NCS presentation mentioned, since 2016, the relationship has become worse and worse. And during that time, Apple was not only able to play ball, but also able to become the first $1 trillion market capitalization company. That is something. That is about some extraordinary corporate diplomacy. And now corporate diplomacy is becoming more important. And this is something I've been teaching my students to do. We want to say this. We want to teach our students who will be executives. The first bullet point, as a direct quote, can we still be friends while I'm withdrawing from your country? It's very difficult to say. Professors, most of your professors, we have some PhD students. Can we say that? Can we still be friends while I'm withdrawing from your country? And this is exactly what Tim Cook did. Take a look at what he did in March of 2023. Because of COVID, he did not visit China for the last 4 years, and he went to participate in a development forum, shaking hands with various Chinese government officials and other stakeholders. And he continues to do this. And make no mistake, he went to China to plan and organize some of the exit actions or exit strategies, if you will, okay? So it is not completely withdrawing, but it's slowly exiting. And this is a more recent picture taken about 6 months ago in October, 2023. When he was shaking hands with the Chinese Minister of Commerce. And again, this is just some very difficult moves to make. But as MNEs, and I believe we as researchers of MNE strategies, we will have to deal with some of these uncomfortable actions, decisions, implementation schemes. So that leads to the new research agenda, right? Most IB and strategy textbooks, including my own, have a great chapter on market entries, which rightly so, because it is supported by a huge research literature. Vast majority of our literature deals with market entries. None has a chapter on market exit strategies, so this becomes a hot new research area as I am embarking on the revision for the sixth edition of my Global Business. You know what? We are going to have a new chapter about international market entries and exits. So How can MNEs leverage corporate diplomacy to manage exit strategies? And one more time, diplomacy doesn't mean only dealing with host country governments and stakeholders who sometimes can be challenging. You know what? You can be Apple and your own home country government may give you trouble. Exhibit A is the recent lawsuit launched by the US government against Apple for alleged monopoly. That means Apple needs to do more on corporate diplomacy dealing with its own home country government in addition to dealing with host country governments. And you know what, why we haven't done much research on exits? Number one, companies, it's not that companies are not doing a lot of exits. Companies have been doing a lot of exits, but under the radar, but generally speaking, it's more exciting to go in. It's easier to conduct corporate diplomacy when you are bringing in capital, technology, generating jobs, proposing to pay more taxes, right? It's actually a lot more challenging if you're telling the host country governments and stakeholders you are getting out. But please, can we still be friends? Can we please still be friends? And that is a very delicate, challenging, but necessary skill and capability that these companies will need to have. So the heart of the new paper is to suggest this very simple 2x2. So the decision is exit or no exit, go or no go. Now it's exit, no exit, right? And sometimes we're not only exiting the host countries, we are also exiting possibly some of the original home countries. And we are talking about moving global headquarters out of your original home country, such as when HSBC did, moving from Hong Kong in the early 1990s. So that is opening up a lot of interesting moves. I'll quickly go through these case studies. McDonald's is a good example, talking about one of hundreds of MNEs getting out of Russia. And the first McDonald's opened in the Soviet Union in 1990. I don't know if you could see, but take a look at where my cursor is. That is a flag of the Soviet Union before 1991. There was the time when the Soviet Union was still around, and it took McDonald's 14 years before 1990 to reach that step. All right. So the amount of challenges, you know, it was too much to recount now. But quickly, fast forward to 2022. Now McDonald's is no longer operating. This is a picture of the first opening of this one called Viksuno e Tochka. In English, it means tasty, and that's it. So McDonald's sold its business to a Russian group populated by current or ex-McDonald's Russian executive team. And very interestingly, you could see how reluctant McDonald's was. It has a 15-year option to buy back its former restaurant. So in the next 15 years, McDonald's is hoping for peace. And I think all of us need to pray for peace in that region and peace in the world so that McDonald's could go back to Russia if needed. Case study two is Pfizer. Pfizer is the one that developed some of the COVID shots that a lot of us took. I personally took one. So Pfizer had faced the similar decision to get out of Russia or not. Well, it came to the decision that the Russians can go on without McDonald's, but Russians, some Russians at least, could not go on without some of the mission critical Pfizer medicines and vaccine shots. So Pfizer decided to continue to provide medicines to Russia to prevent suffering and potential loss of life, but no more new clinical trials and investments. And in this day and age of CSR, in case anyone criticizes Pfizer for being greedy, for profits only, blah, 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 Pfizer said, you know what, we're going to be donating all the money, all the profit we made out of Russia to Ukraine relief efforts. So these decisions, direct quote from Pfizer, align with our patient first values and ensure that every dollar of profit derived from Russia will strengthen Ukraine and its people, so on and so forth. So Pfizer made a different decision, basically. The decision is not preordained, despite pressures from Pfizer's home country government to get out of Russia.
Mike, we should really wind up about now or fairly soon.
Okay, let's just talk about this moving from Hong Kong to London. And then spend a minute on this one. Everybody heard about TikTok. TikTok is a company that's in deep trouble in the host country, the United States. Relatively few people heard about that TikTok is 100% owned by ByteDance. ByteDance is headquartered in Beijing, and ByteDance has debated about moving its headquarters out of China. Long story short, ByteDance said, if we moved out of China, the Xi government is not going to be happy. And the fact that majority of our business is in Beijing and in China will stay in China as our headquarters location. TikTok already moved its headquarters to the United States and Singapore. Two pictures at the bottom are visual illustrations of how to deal with host country government and stakeholders. The last slide, in conclusion, this requires a lot of work, or diplomatic work, both at the country level and the corporate level, requires nurturing and managing relationships over a long period of time with understanding, patience, and goodwill. And we simply need to do more research in this aspect, especially we need to prepare our students and our executive clients and executive training, executive education students, practitioners, how to deal with this. We need to understand how can we manage relationships, legitimacy, and stakeholders. Ultimately, I would argue, using my familiar term, managing institutions as rules of the game. There are institutions governing exit strategies. We just need to do a good job dissecting, taking a deep dive into these institutions, which can become the new frontier of the institution-based view. That is the end of my presentation. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mike. We've had a lot of questions, and there are a few questions specifically to Mike in the chat that I hope Mike and might be able to pick up. And I know the other panelists have also picked up some questions. Klaus Jacobs has tried to make sense of this all in a very, very brave contribution, which might also encourage people to engage with him. So please do use the chat, but I'm going to move on to Pasha right now. And I hope he'll be able to introduce more perspectives for Klaus to try and make sense of. Thank you, Pasha.
Hi, Richard. Hi, thanks, Mike. Thanks, Anthea. Thanks, Aline. So today I'm going to talk about work that I'm doing with my colleague, Marlene Dilleman and Ed Zajac. So this is about how do firms deal with regulators in nascent markets or new markets. Now, let me see if I can get this. I usually do empirical work, but this was a kind of extension of the cases that I have been writing for the last few years. And what I was observing was very interesting phenomena for, let's say, motorcycle ride-sharing firms in Indonesia or mobile payments in Bangladesh. They were operating at a zone when there was no regulation, which basically they say that they couldn't do something, or they said they could do something. So there was this lack of regulations that created a zone of discretion. And we saw a lot of approaches to deal with that kind of discretion, because there was no regulation per se for ride sharing in motorcycle ride sharing or online payments in Bangladesh. So this is some like Gojek, they completely ignored the regulator. They bypassed the regulator. They didn't talk to the regulator. Then this company called Bikash in Bangladesh, they work very closely with the regulator from day one. They kind of co-created the regulatory framework that Aline was talking about. And then you had somebody who wanted to use customer legitimacy as a way to get regulatory legitimacy. Remember, if customer loves you, the government will have to love you. Now, all businesses face legal issues as part of their business operations, and companies naturally would like the laws that apply to them to be favorable. But some companies enter a line of business that has a legal issue at its core, a significant uncertainty regarding how the law will apply to a main part of their business operations, a need for new regulations in order for products to be feasible or profitable, or a legal restriction that prevents the long-term operations of the business. So this is from legal scholars. They have been spending quite a bit of time trying to understand how these new business models that are coming, how do they deal with regulators? So this is a bit different. So the research that we are doing, our goal is to identify some of these firm-specific, some organization-specific factors, some institutional factors that might affect the optimal regulatory strategy in nascent markets. Now, it's increasingly relevant but understudied. So, for example, we heard about non-market strategy literature, and there's a lot of work in non-market strategy literature that focus on how established firms pursue regulatory strategies like lobbying literature, capture versus compliance kind of actions. Then there's also literature in new market creation that focus on how firms address customer legitimacy, customer uncertainty, but that underplays the regulatory aspect of it. Now, there is relevant work on institutional strategy, if you look at and category creation, new category creation, like Shu and Grodal, or Gao and MacDonald and Garud, that basically deal with the co-evolutionary process that leads to the creation of new markets. What we thought we need a more general theory on how to decide on the regulatory engagement strategy. For example, what should be the optimal strategy and how should it vary with different kind of firm characteristics, institutional characteristics, organizational characteristics. That's what we wanted to do. Now, first, what do we mean by nascent markets? Now, when you are an Uber, or when you are Gojek, or when you are Bkash, or when you are in Tunaiku in Indonesia, you have to have two, in a way, you have two customers to deal with. One is the typical customers who decide whether to buy your product or service. You exist because somebody is willing to pay for your product or service. So you have to have customer legitimacy. And so you have to deal with this market ambiguity. But at the same time, you also have regulator. You need regulatory legitimacy, which gives you the license to play. So you have to also have the regulatory ambiguity. How should the regulations pan out? So you have two kinds of customers, so to speak. One is the typical customers who decides whether to buy your product or service. And then you have the regulator who decides how to deal with you. Now, in the case of, because there is no clear market yet, so you have high market ambiguity. If you look at between low and high, and you have low regulatory ambiguity, high regulatory ambiguity. Nascent market is when you have both high market ambiguity and high regulatory ambiguity. On the other hand, if you look at the extreme bottom left, you have low market ambiguity, market has already emerged, and regulations have already been crystallized. So you have low market ambiguity. So nascent market is characterized by both kinds of ambiguities. Now, the dilemma of the innovator, like, or we call it market creator, is that, think about this. The challenge in the marketplace from the customer's point of view is, how do you stand out? How do you make the customer look at you, accept you, and make you stand out from others? From the point of view of the regulator is, how do you fit in? So you have this dilemma, is that you have, the more you fit in, the less likely you are going to be subject to regulatory backlash. But on the other hand, the more you want to engage with the regulators, it takes time, energy, and it might actually reduce your, compromise your ability to fit in, ability to experiment with market, pivot, and all these things. So that creates the dilemma. So seeking greater regulatory legitimacy comes with the cost of autonomy loss associated with compliance. And the higher the regulatory engagement, the higher the level of time, attention, and resources. So let me repeat what I'm trying to say. So in the nascent market, you need two kinds of legitimacy. You need market legitimacy, which is typically the customer legitimacy, and then you need regulatory legitimacy. You need customer engagement to get the customer legitimacy. You need regulatory engagement to get the regulatory legitimacy. The problem is, the more you try to do the regulatory legitimacy by engaging with the regulator, the less time and energy and resources you have to deal with customers. And sometimes the regulator will actually tell you, this is what you can do, this is what you cannot do. So there is a trade-off here. And our research question is to explore, how does the nature of trade-off depend? How does it vary depending on, for example, what is your business model? What kind of industry you come from? What are the characteristics of the investor? what kind of institutional context the firm finds itself. For example, if you are, your business model depends on platform, on demand externality, it's very important for you to get as many customers as quickly as possible. So you probably don't want to waste time. Probably you care a lot about the speed. So the cost of dealing with a regulator is higher for you. As opposed to if you look at some other kind of investors, for them like a family or reputation is very important. The stigma that comes from being delegitimized might be more important. So depending on the relative importance you put on customer versus the regulator, so your optimal engagement strategy would vary. So look at this case. Think about social benefit and social risk. You have low social benefit, high social risk, or low social risk, high social risk. And depending on what kind of business model you have, regulator would give you different sorts of restrictions. So for example, if you're Khan Academy, you don't expect the regulator to come and shut you down. So what it means is that your marginal cost is likely to be flatter. So you would be so you can continue to engage with the regulator without having to give up much of autonomy. On the other hand, if you're doing something which is fintech, which is a little bit more complicated because it could be socially inclusive, but at the same time, it could have negative spillover effect. So this is just an example. So we go on several of these things. So very quickly, two other points. Although this research basically builds on this idea that there is a trade-off, but we understand that sometimes you don't have a trade-off. You actually have a case when you need the regulatory legitimacy to gain the customer legitimacy. So it's not that if you actually, when you're having more regulatory legitimacy, you're going to have less. Sometimes you actually need the regulatory legitimacy to get the customer legitimacy. So we think about that kind of things. And also, we talk about the substitutive mechanism, which is when actually, instead of engaging with the regulator directly, what you do is you actually engage with customers. And because you engage the customers, the regulator needs legitimacy too. Because the customers love you, regulators are more likely to be nice to you. So this is an alternative. So in the first speaker, I think Aline was talking about the link between state and the firm and the civic society. So it is like this. Instead of dealing directly with the state, you deal with the civic society and have the civic society put pressure on the regulator, the state. This is one way of doing. So if that's the case, actually the marginal benefit is likely to be less because somebody else is doing it for you. So you don't need to engage. Now, second thing, which we don't have time here to do it, is you see the restriction is not exogenous. Whether regulator want to have more or less restriction also depends on how you as a firm have been dealing with the regulator. So there is a dynamic interaction there. So what we are trying to do is to bring that kind of dynamic interaction to explain where you can have path dependency. For example, because you engage with the regulator first time, regulator invites you to join the sandbox. Because you join the sandbox and you share the regulatory experiments, you are asked to be a co-creator. Not everybody can actually do these things. So there is some kind of a dynamic interaction there. So that's what we have been trying to do. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Pasha. That's very interesting. Certainly in the UK, there's an awful lot of regulatory issues with our basic utilities. So I think the regulatory, even old established industries, have very very uncertain regulatory environments. So I think your issues are very relevant. Now, there's been some good chat, and I do draw everyone's attention to that. And maybe people will put questions to Pasha. Thank you, Aline, Anthea, Mike, for contributing to the chat. And Anna has also mentioned her forthcoming Journal of Management Studies special issue, which I think is a good launch pad for her own and last presentation. Aline, please go ahead.
I'm sorry?
Oh.
So thank you very much, Richard and Louise, for organizing this webinar symposium. I'm really delighted to be part of such a distinguished panel. My research is almost entirely related to the role of state in the economy. So I'm really delighted to be part of that panel. And I would like to launch straight into the special issue that we are writing with the Journal of Management Studies on that field. So the role of state and how the firms respond with their strategies to this increasing involvement of state in the economy. So anything on ownership, institutions and beyond, including corporate political ties, corporate diplomacy, interactions between home and host governments in the context of internationalization. So we're looking at all kinds of submissions, and we're trying to shape this around this new construct, which we call state capitalism, which is an ambiguous concept, but essentially it is a system where the state is becoming an economic actor. So, for example, as an owner of economic entities such as state-owned enterprises and sovereign wealth funds, and beyond ownership, it's also the way for the state to use various tools for proactive intervention in economic functioning of the countries, the home countries or the host countries. So the management scholarship has begun rethinking the role of the state, and what we're trying to do with the special issue, we're trying to encourage scholars to come up with new theoretical perspectives on the role of state, because the theories that have been developed around the role of state are a little bit dated. So either they have been developed during the earlier phases of the role of state, which primarily were manifesting through privatization, or they were based as management theories on advanced economies. So we're looking at refreshing this theoretical umbrella that will bring our scholarship in line with what is happening now, with what we see around the world, with the different types of intervention tools that the states are using to impact the economies, to impact the firm strategies. So anything you know, that you would think of that would contribute to the development of management theories, and we have seen in the past the use of resource dependence theory, because this is something that the firms are doing when they're looking to, you know, attract the state resources and kind of the mutual embeddedness between the firms and the state's resource-based view, using the connections to the governments as a sustainable advantage, agency theory. We're looking at agency theory from a fresh perspective, and developing, of course, institutional theory that has seen a prominent intake in the last 10 years through primarily international business studies that look at states in a comparative perspective. And then other theories that you might want to bring if you are an interdisciplinary scholar from political science or sociology of development into the management literature. So we are encouraging different theoretical contributions to this special issue, and also a broad array of methodological contributions from qualitative studies to large scale quantitative studies, and studies, of course, in different contexts. And if you are interested in purely submitting a conceptual piece, like Klaus was commenting, you know, what are the different types of state involvement in the economy, how state acts as a regulator, as an economic agent, as a, you know, investor through sovereign wealth funds, there may be you know, as a way of sort of influencing other governments. We have a paper that I come later in the Journal of International Business Studies that talk about the discrete power of states. So anything, we would be really happy to receive your contributions. So we're looking at primarily building out a theoretical understanding of how this, the role of state or state capitalism impacts firms and firm strategies in various contexts. So how does state capitalism impact firms within the state orbit. So you might have research on state-owned enterprises or sovereign wealth funds, but also how does state capitalism impact firms operating in context with high incidences of state capitalism. So that could be firms that do not have direct state ownership, but are national champions or are operating in strategic and sensitive industries that might be subject to state interference. So it's a really kind of broadly scoped special issue. So let's talk about state and firm strategies. How do firms respond to the increasing involvement of state in the economy? So, of course, it depends on various factors, and we're looking to uncover this in a special issue. So the state intervention that we have seen recently has a variety of forms. It could also be, it could be through bailouts, as we've seen during the COVID-19 pandemic in a lot of economies. Even traditionally, those economies where the state takes the back role behind the market, the state has increased its role as an economic agent. For example, in the UK, there were a number of firms being bailed out because otherwise they would have failed. Another interesting aspect of state intervention is through investments, and I will come to that in a minute. Through sovereign wealth funds, some countries have managed to acquire a considerable amount of assets abroad. And how does this work? You know, what would those entities impose some kind of, you know, political goals in addition to financial goals on the companies that they own? So these are very interesting questions that we are yet to be that are yet to be answered. And then other ways of state intervention, perhaps more subtle, through subsidies or industrial policies, are also interesting. So It would be nice to focus on particular industries, and these industries can be taken on a global scale. So we haven't seen any studies on the role of state in, let's say, oil and gas around the world, right? Not just in a particular country, not just in China or US, but how does this play on a global scale? So looking at a particular industry, but across different institutional contexts would be really relevant. And then, of course, you can, if you are a specialist in a particular context, you can dig further into an understudied political or economic context. So, for example, we are lacking studies in countries where state has a prominent role, like Middle East or Africa, but that have for some reason been understudied in this kind of literature. So looking at uncovering these additional contexts. So why the manifestation of state in any shape or form is an important topic for us as scholars to study? And I'm taking here an example of the UK, because I'm living in the UK and I'm fascinated by that country that has traditionally been considered as a liberal market economy, but that has seen a considerable influence of state-owned entities from abroad over the years. And here I'm looking at how this influence has shifted over the years, because it really depends on the flavor of the months. So it depends on the changes in the political regime, on the ideology, on the leadership. So in the UK, we have seen in the early 90s up to 2010, investments by Russia, by Russian oligarchs. So UK has also invested in Russian oil and gas through the joint ventures with between BT and Rosneft that has now been dismantled. So this, has, of course, dried out during the 2014 and ongoing during the sanctions against Russia and Russian oligarchs. And at the same time, you can see that the capital coming from Russia has been gradually replaced by other state-owned capital. So in the 2010s, China was investing heavily in the UK, but then recently, there has been also an increased disengagement from joint interests with China. And we have seen this really strong government rhetoric mentioning the surveillance or cybersecurity threat, the International Foreign Office investigating every single investment coming from China and essentially giving the last say on whether that investment can go through or not. So a number of investment has been turned down. Some things have also been dismantled, like stripping off the entire Huawei 5G network that has brought disruption to the UK infrastructure because, you know, it has not really been replaced by something else. Also, the government has bought out China's interest from the nuclear power plant investment, which amounted to hundreds of millions of dollars. So why are we not investigating, you know, this shift, right, in the government rhetoric and how this influences firm strategies? I think this is a really important topic, but yet we have not seen any papers coming out of this. So lately, you know, we have observed the replacement of capital. So instead of Russia or China, the UK government is now suddenly very favorable to other regimes. And I don't know if one regime is better than the other. So now we have seen from 2020 a huge inflow of capital from sovereign wealth funds and mostly from Middle East. So the total investment from Middle Eastern sovereign wealth funds is about $65 billion into the UK. It's a huge amount of money. And so we don't necessarily know how much is invested in the UK until we sort of add up all these 5 to 10% investments by different sovereign wealth funds. So again, this is an interesting dynamic to investigate. Does it create a threat because of, you know, maybe it's not a threat because they are sort of owning individually 5 to 10% of each asset, but combined, you know, it's a huge investment in some of the, you know, strategic assets in the UK, in real estate, in life sciences. So this is in technology. So this is not negligible. So this kind of brings me to the next topic where I want to talk about...
I know, we should probably make this the last slide.
Yeah. So this is the published paper, so you could look it up. I just want you to sort of take away one idea from that slide. So there are different ways that the state can use state-owned entities, whether that's state-owned enterprises or sovereign funds, to influence the economies abroad. And so in this Journal of International Business Studies, we propose the theoretical framework that you can test if you have the data on your own institutional context. So this kind of is a 2x2 matrix where the states go abroad with objectives that are either economic or social and that are either directed to improve their own economies or improve the standing of their economies abroad. And so, this is something that you could take forward and test empirically. And then the final slide to conclude is the response of the firms to this increased role of state. So how do firms deal with state intervention? Well, they deal primarily through corporate political ties. And so this is another publication that that I've worked on with colleagues. And so you could essentially continue this work by looking further into the different types of corporate political ties and how they impact firm performance and firm strategies and governance. And this, again, there's a number of theoretical perspectives that can be used to develop this this work. So my top three research questions, and Richard, I conclude on that slide, would be around basically the internationalization. So what strategies do firms use to evade government economic activism, and how they use international expansion to reduce government influence, and what happens if government influence is reversed? So that goes back to the previous slide on corporate political ties. So when the state is captured by the firms through this corporate political ties mechanism. And then finally, and that also relates to this mutual embeddedness, what is the optimal distance from the state under various forms of state capitalism? Because you can never be far away from the states, as we have seen even in the UK. So thank you so much. And I look forward to interacting with you more on that topic.
Thank you so much, Anna. That's a great way of finishing, because I think Faisal Altari, I think I got your name nearly right, raised the issue during the presentations that basically the state is getting more important. I think all five of the panelists have revealed, exposed, and encouraged all sorts of issues about the state for research. Grateful to you all. What's wonderful is that Anna has this Journal of Management Studies special issue coming out. Aline mentioned what seems to me to be a very relevant strategic management journal special issue coming out, or looking for papers on dealing with grand challenges where the state will also be important. Pina Ozkan, one of my colleagues, is a co-editor of that. So I think this is a time to encourage more research and to note that there are more outlets for publication than there have been for a very long period of time. So this is a great opportunity, especially for new researchers to get involved in this really important but neglected area of research. One last time, let me thank all the panelists and also all those who've contributed via the chat. Thank you so much. And with that, I think I should bring it all to a close. This will be available on video on the AOM's website fairly soon. It usually takes a week or two, so you'll be able to pursue things there. Okay, thank you very much, Aline, Anthea, Mike, Pasha, Anna. Lovely to have you on the panel.